Back together again, you and I chatting it up. Midweek Wednesday style, June 18th, 2025 on Connecticut Today, where we jump right into a tough decision facing President Trump. Should the U.S. military take part in operations to cripple Iran's ability to produce a nuclear weapon? University of New Haven Associate Professor of Homeland and National Security, Political Science and International Affairs, Dr. Matthew Schmidt, joined the program again, and he discussed that very issue as well. And Hearst, Connecticut Media senior columnist and editor Dan Haar talked about covering former President Barack Obama's visit to Connecticut on Tuesday night.
So it's a big question. It's a major question that, as you just heard, top of the hour from CBS News, and if you've heard all day today and the past overnight, even starting yesterday, American forces, American troops, American military personnel, American planes, American armaments, should they, will they be used along with or in concert with Israeli forces to deal a knockout blow, not necessarily to the people of Iran? Again, remember, when we talk about this stuff, you really should differentiate between governments that may be hostile to us and hostile all around the world, and the people of a nation. I'm sure you and I or millions of other Americans out there could have a nice lunch or dinner or sit around and talk about world affairs with, you know, an Iranian couple, an Iranian family from Tehran or anywhere else in that country that was once a shining star of the Middle East, and sit there and shake our heads about what our collective governments do. That's not the issue here. The issue is this, and I'll ask this to start the discussion today on this midweek Wednesday, the 18th of June, 2025. Should, in fact, I put this as our question of the day today. Check it out, facebook.com/voiceofct. Pretty simple question. Should President Trump authorize the use of U.S. military forces to help Israel cripple Iran's nuclear program? Now, from what the experts are saying, the program could even have survived all these hits by Israel because of these one or two really hardened below-ground bunkers that would need these bunker busters that even the Israeli Air Force cannot deliver. So they were turned to us to do it, and now you see the saber-rattling from Iran. Well, no surprise here, and there would be people that say they'd be justified in doing it, warning the U.S., saying, hey, if you take part in this any further than you are helping Israel, you know, it's all bets are off here. We will target your troops. We will target your planes. And, folks, they've been saying for years that Iran has these, you know, sleeper cells all around the U.S. Could be some here in Connecticut. Who knows? But you'd maybe have to take that into account. So what do you think? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, 333-9422. That's talk or text. If you don't want to come on the radio because you don't want to be heard or you can't or whatever, send me a text. Type in the text to your voice to text or speak it and send it here at 333-9422. Should the White House and President Trump authorize the use of U.S. military forces to help Israel cripple Iran's nuclear program? Now, I'm assuming that that's what it would be. Now, would it be for regime change? I don't know. Listen, I've been told by a couple of experts over the years, including an Iranian professor I used to consult with years ago at another station, and he said to me, he goes, and he would go back to Iran once or twice a year to visit his family, and he would tell me, he said, Paul, don't take the phony anti-American protests you see in the media as credible, because they're not. They're staged. All this death to America stuff, he told me back then at the time, was just a bunch of garbage here. That the younger generations of Iranians, including at one time Iran, you know, was the youngest by average age country in the world, because they lost an entire generation of young men in the Iran-Iraq war back in, wait, the 70s and 80s, I think that was. They want to be more aligned with the West. That's what he was telling me. And I even saw a special a few months ago that said, once you get out of the militant areas of Tehran, a lot of Iranians, some of whom still refer to themselves as Persians, want better relationships with the West. They want to meet and interact with Americans. They want the tourist money to come into Iran. I mean, think about that. I'm old enough to remember, because I'm getting up there. I'm old enough to remember in the late 60s and early to mid 70s, seeing on New York television stations commercial TV spots for New York City-based and Westchester County-based travel agents. Remember when you couldn't book your own airlines or hotels? You had to go through a travel agent? What are those, Mom? Saying that they specialized in Middle East tourism and trips to Iran. It was considered a very cultured, very cutting-edge place to visit in the Middle East. It would, you know, they compared it to, well, Tehran was compared to Rome or Paris or whatever. So should we rely or should we join in with the Israeli military and maybe some other forces to return that part of the world to a more, I don't want to say simpler time, but a time where Iran was not considered, as it is right now by many experts, and I'll have one on later on in the show today, it was not considered one of the fulcrums of international tension. So how would you feel about that? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. What about American involvement here? U.S. military involvement in maybe a final push here by Israel to cripple permanently, they hope, the capacity of Iran to construct and build a nuclear bomb or, you know, purify or do whatever they have to do to get the uranium to do that. Or is that a slippery slope? Would that, you know, is that taking a stick and poking it in a hornet's nest? Not a very easy decision for Mr. Trump. If you were in the Oval Office, what would you tell him?
In the last couple of days, the president seems to have moved more closely to seeing the United States get directly involved, and in particular, using our military assets to strike that Fordo nuclear facility. We saw him depart prematurely from the G7 summit to return to Washington. We know he spent all day on Tuesday meeting frequently with his national security team and senior advisors.
That's a retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS News, a frequent guest here on the radio station, in particular on this program here. And Colonel McCausland saying here what has piqued his interest here. And well, I got to tell you, whether you despise Donald Trump or whether you're an enthusiastic supporter of his administration, you have to admit, this is a tough decision. It really is. What would you do in this situation? Now, again, remember, there's not an active war going on, and there are already people on both sides of the aisle in Washington saying, hey, you know, he really shouldn't be doing this without authorization from Congress. And you know what? When it comes to that, I don't care who's in the White House, Republican or Democratic. I mean, you always have. And again, it's what they want to claim. I get it. I understand that. But the notion of needing a declaration of war against somebody is almost, I don't want to say it's completely gone, but come on, you and I always know that when this happens, it almost never comes with a formal declaration of war. I mean, this isn't, you know, Pearl Harbor all over again here. But nonetheless, it's a tough decision here. So what should he do, knowing that Americans could be killed? That's what you have to worry about here. You're in a situation, and you can't sit, well, there's no going to be troops on the ground. They're doing everything from the air. Well, yeah, but planes get shot down. You know, these airborne munitions are pretty incredible stuff. It's incredible stuff out there. The pinpoint accuracy, the ability to target from hundreds or thousands of miles away, offshore or on land. But the question is it worth it? There are people who would say, yeah, it is. If you can finally undo a hazardous government. You may say, well, it's only a fight between Israel and Iran. Well, that's really not accurate. Because look it up online, ask any national security or world security expert, and they will tell you, and we've talked about it, and you know, with experts on this show over the years, and I have, the literal tentacles that Iran has in threatening people all around the world in the name largely of the repressionist interpretation of Islam. And many of those mullahs, if not all of them, still do not accept the right of Israel to exist. So if you were Israel, how would you feel about that? And again, it's not easy. When people may die, nothing is easy. Nothing becomes theoretical if there's dead bodies anymore. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, talk or text. Should American military forces be involved? Doesn't necessarily mean boots on the ground, but again, remember, we have bases in the Middle East. It could lead to an attack on an American military base. Then what? Even if the U.S. doesn't formally assist Israel in this, what if, you know, in the next few days, Iran says, well, screw that. We're going to attack military bases anyway. And this is why a lot of people over the years have said, some pointing to mystical cues, others pointing to geopolitical forces, that if World War III starts, it'll be in the Middle East. Francis in Stratford joins us. Francis, you're first up. What's going on?
Hello. Well, I have the impossible dream.
Okay.
They have to put all their religion aside.
Yeah.
I understand they're up to their eyeballs in it. And have Trump, Netanyahu, whoever and whoever, all like the G7, around the table. And we see their stuff, they see our stuff, and let's make peace somehow.
Yeah. You know, Francis, somebody wrote a column exactly saying that a couple of days ago. It's very similar to what you just said, that try and strip the religious hatred out of it. And take a look, Francis, at exactly what you said and have everybody ask themselves, can't we all just live in peace? Can we get along? But the point of this column is, was Francis, according to your aligning with what you were saying, is that the religious part of it is so deeply soaked into the leadership there, there's a doubt it could ever happen.
No, I don't believe that, because I did hospitals all my life.
Yeah.
I took care of the worst of the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
You know what? I never asked them their religion.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just make them better.
Yeah. Good point. Francis, thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah. In fact, I think, was it our buddy Eric Erickson? Somebody had wrote something the other day, and forgive me if I don't remember what it was, but pretty akin to what Francis in Stratford just said. That likely if you stripped away the religious fanaticism in Iran, which is what it is. Now you may say, well, you know, Israel's a religious state. Well, maybe it is, but the leadership of Israel is secular. It's not a religious-backed leadership in Israel. It's not. And many Arabs live in Israel, too. People don't realize that. Which is why it's important, people say, for Israel to survive in the Middle East. But yeah, that'd be a nice, you know, maybe it's Shangri-La to think it could happen. But, you know, if everybody just got along in the area, that'd be wonderful. But again, you know, you look at some of these, not even centuries old, but millennia, thousands of years old, you know, religious differences, not just between Christians, Jews, and Muslims, but various facts of Islam, too, F-A-C-T-S, of Islam, too, which makes it so difficult. So what do you think here? Should we formally commit U.S. forces, U.S. technology, U.S. assistance? Now, if you don't think we're assisting Israel now, you ain't with it. Of course we are. Now, I know Mr. Trump says, well, no American forces are involved. Yeah, okay, I guess technically he's right. What are your thoughts on this? Love to hear it. 203-333-9422-333-WICC.
We have 40,000 troops, roughly, in the region. And as soon as you strike Fordo, you've put all those people on a bullseye for potential retaliation, either directly by Iran, which has missile capabilities that could strike almost all those locations in places like Iraq, Syria, Qatar, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, et cetera, or offshore.
Part of the analysis from one of the contributors we bring in sometimes on a national basis, retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS News, and one of our great local experts on world hotspots when things like this happen. And, you know, if this happens at the worst end, you may see service members with Connecticut ties drawn into this. Joining us right now is Dr. Matthew Schmidt. He, of course, of the University of New Haven, Associate Professor of Homeland and National Security, Political Science, and International Affairs. Matt, it's Paul here. Good to have you back. How are you?
Hey, Paul. It's great to be here.
Well, give us the grand view of this before we get to the minutiae here, Matt, and I'm sure you've been poring over this. I mean, wow. Do you think Mr. Trump has made a decision yet? Is this kind of gamesmanship that he's doing here or not? Because, man, he better be right on this one.
No, I think there's two things to keep in mind. Number one, we've seen for years, first term and now, that Trump seems to have a real aversion to wars. He is uncomfortable with the idea that he would put the U.S. in one. I think he's uncomfortable with the idea of the death. Number two, Netanyahu's largest plan here was to trap Trump into a position where he would have to get involved, essentially. So it's kind of like Iran was a hornet's nest and Israel went and whacked the hornet's nest and got rid of, you know, two thirds of its capacity. But that one third is left. And the only country that has the capacity to most likely hit it is the United States. And now the U.S. is looking at this and going, man, we didn't want to do this.
Yeah.
But now, do we have to do it because we have an Iran that 100%, right, is going to push for nuclear enrichment and for a bomb now, so we better stop it if we can. And that's the trap, that's the strategic trap that Netanyahu very much intended to put Trump in.
So with that being said, let's look at it, Matt, from the other side here. What do you think the Iranian people want? What do you think the common Iranian in the street, walking, well, maybe not walking home now, but, you know, last couple of weeks, yeah, whatever, I'm doing my job or I have dinner plans tonight or whatever. What is the Iranian culture of people feeling about this? What do you think?
So Iranians want to live, and they want to live a normal life. They have been fighting for better economic opportunities for years, for decades, since the sanctions have been in place. Mm-hmm. And they basically want to normalize things. They're not fans of the regime. They are not willing to take to the streets yet because it's a huge risk to their lives, to their families' lives. I think we underestimate how difficult that decision is. You know, but there's been significant movement in that direction just a few years ago with the Green Revolution,
yep.
You know, with women's rights. And so we know that the putative opposition leaders are saying, you know, this is an opportunity. Maybe we can get people in the streets. But my sense is that what this kind of attack does is actually increase nationalism, right? The mm-hmm. Iranians are basically saying, don't do this to Iran. We love our country, even if we hate our government.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're not going to rebel now, right?
Interesting. Now, Matt, what about the notion here that you've read and I've read, and you tell me how believable this is. We've always been told, we in the media here, the American people consuming this, that, hey, you never know because Iran has these, I guess they're referred to as sleeper cells, as insurgents strategically placed in certain parts of the world. And if something like this happened, an attack by the U.S. or teaming up with Israel, they would go into action. Do you buy any of that or some of it or none of it?
I don't buy that there's this wide network of sleeper cells and sort of the Hollywood sense of this. Of course, what they could do, and they've done this all over the Middle East and proven their capability, is to use proxies, right, to engage in terrorist attacks. And I think that is the worry that Americans should have, whether that attack comes from, you know, their neighbor, that's a sleeper cell, or in the coming years, from someone, you know, who's moving from Iran around the world and gets here, I think is a, you know, is sort of an irrelevant story. But that's the other thing, too, is that Iran's going to be patient. They're not going to punch back right now at the U.S. If that happens, it's going to take a long time, months or years, to put those operations in place.
Dr. Matthew Schmidt, University of New Haven Associate Professor of Homeland and National Security, Political Science and International Affairs, talking about the Iran-Israel situation. Let's look into the Matthew Schmidt crystal ball, shall we, Matt? I know it's there. Sure. I know you have it revved up in front of you. Let's say that... Let's play two different scenarios here. Hypotheticals. Hypothetical one. This turns out as best it can turn out. The U.S. teams up with Israel. We know we've destroyed their nuclear capacity, and the people overthrow the mullahs. I know I'm talking pie in the sky here. So in that case, Matt, before we look at the polar opposite, in that case, what does Iran begin to look like in a few years? Any big changes?
It begins to look, you know, sort of like Iraq. It's going to do a lot better economically, and you're going to see that it has a highly educated population, and of course it has oil and mineral wealth, and so it's going to look something like it did, you know, pre-revolution, right, in the early 70s or the 1960s.
Yeah. You know, before we get to the polar opposite of that, Matt, I was telling my listeners earlier, I'm old enough, I'm an old guy, I remember watching, Matt, New York television, you know, rabbit ears, no cable, and they would advertise these travel agencies and travel agents, you know, well before people can make their own, you know, flight plans. And there was one or two agencies in New York that would specialize in trips to Iran, and they would show Tehran and they would show all these cities. And even as a young kid, I'm like, wow, that looks like a pretty cool place to visit. Might we ever get back there for a time?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, look, I have an uncle from there, and I can totally see that happening. I have a good friend who is an American who was born in Tehran because her dad was stationed there as an American serviceman in the 1970s. You know, and I think Americans today just don't understand that. They see Iran in one dimension, but most of the population thinks about the world more like they did in the 1970s than they agree with the, you know, the radical mullahs.
Yeah, all right. So now let's flip a coin, look at the complete opposite. How bad, Matt Schmidt, can this get if Mr. Trump or anybody makes a wrong move here?
It can get really bad. As your previous guest said, if there's an attack on Fordow, successful or not, then Iran is going to be really pressured to respond and to attack American bases. That said, people need to understand that best guess, there's 2,000 to 3,000 missiles that they can hit Israel or roughly speaking, American bases. They've already expended 15-20% of those missiles. And they can't go to zero because they'll have no deterrent at that point. So, you know, I think you could see a lot of stuff flying, but they can't shoot out 1,000 missiles or they'll have nothing left in the gun. So that's what Netanyahu is calculating on, you know, right here. And so the next worst case scenario is that they start you know, attacking shipping or engaging in terrorism outside of the region.
Matt, final question here. What do you think the other nations are thinking there? Not necessarily what they're saying in public, but what they're thinking, you know, the UAE and Qatar and Iraq and Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. What are they thinking right now?
Look, they're angry at Israel, one, because they don't like Israel. But more importantly, in private, they're angry at Israel because they've upset the status quo, right? The rest of the Gulf states, Middle East is going, we had this under control. We had an agreement. Iran was slow rolling enrichment. Everybody understood that. They had an interest in keeping up the idea that they were going to build a bomb, but they understood that if they would build a bomb, it might actually create less security for them. And now Netanyahu has gone and done this cowboy move, which is going to destabilize the whole region. So they're really upset about that because it felt like things were stable. And now they don't know where it's going, and they don't have control. You know, Israel does.
Dr. Matthew Schmidt, University of New Haven, Associate Professor of Homeland and National Security, Political Science, and International Affairs. Matt, always good to chat with you. I'm sure in the coming weeks we'll chat down the road. Thank you once again.
Take care, Paul.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. There you go. All right. Our weekly midweek chat with Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media Senior Editor and columnist, about all the big stories around the state, including an appearance by one former president, Barack Obama, in Hartford last night. Mr. Haar was there. Dan, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. How is it? How's everything down in Bridgeport, greater Fairfield County?
We're living the dream, Dan. We certainly are. And I read with interest your very good story. People should read it if they can access it on former President Obama at the Bushnell last night, part of a speaker series. And I like the tone of your story, Dan. He is always, no matter what he's thinking, one thing that has impressed me about him, he's always very measured and succinct and I would even say humble about what he says. And I think that makes him all the more interesting to listen to these days.
Yeah, I agree with that. And he's speaking more deliberately than ever now. I did not realize it last night, but what happened was in thinking back over it, his voice was a lot slower,
mm-hmm.
right? And I don't think that means he has any kind of cognitive or you know, Biden type issues.
Yeah.
But it could be age related, just in the sense that you get older, you think more carefully
sure.
as you speak, right? Because he was never known as a super fast talker like John F. Kennedy, you know,
yeah.
one of those guys.
Yeah.
But when he speaks, it's very hard to take sound bites, A, because he's so careful.
Yes.
You know, and that's
yes.
the main thing I want to talk about is
yeah.
that most Democrats that I've talked to, which is to say most people that were there last night, I'm
yeah.
not aware of any Trump supporters or Republicans who were at the Connecticut Forum
yeah.
For Barack Obama. It was a hometown crowd. The crowd was divided between thinking, wow, this is great. This is just the Obama, you know, a dose of the old Barack, just like we love and know and love,
mm-hmm.
versus those who say, you know, how does a guy give an hour and 7 minute talk on stage this week of all weeks with
yeah.
everything going on, deportations, California, the parade, everything else? And didn't mention the word Trump.
Yeah.
Now, he referred to Trump, of
yeah.
course, and he criticized Trump by saying, you know, a president. But, you know, to me, it's as Lamont likes to say, too cute by half.
I honestly think, Dan, and you can agree with me on this or not, I think that he takes his audience as having a certain level of understanding where he's coming from. Yet, in dealing with these people for years, I find that if they kind of avoid the obvious, maybe those sound bites or what he said kind of appeals to that middle voter, or maybe even, Dan, perish the thought, even a few Trump voters. In other words, I don't think he wants to give out red meat when he talks, and I think he's smart enough and brilliant enough to say, listen, I don't have to say the word Trump, but people know what I'm doing here. I'm going to stay above the fray. Yes or no? What do you think?
Well, I think that's the theory. But my question for you is, clearly he's appealing to the educated professional class liberal Democrat,
mm-hmm.
right? But with his long 400-word ideas and all that stuff. Clearly, clearly that.
Yeah.
Right? But the question is he also – look – the winner of the presidency is the person who gets the working class, typically white male.
Sure.
In the industrial, you know, the old Reagan Democrat.
Yeah.
Right. Whoever gets the majority of that group wins. Right. Because, you know, the Democrats are going to get the urban professional, you know, liberals, obviously. And you know that the Republicans are going to get the cultural Republicans,
mm-hmm.
And some of the other traditionalists. But it's that group that swings, and that's why the swing states are Wisconsin, Michigan, and Ohio
mm-hmm.
in the northern Rust Belt.
Yeah.
So Obama got those voters, right? So are you saying that by not mentioning Trump, he might get some of those voters? Because if that's the case, I'm glad he didn't mention Trump.
I think he's trying to lay out his argument in a way that, Dan, he may subtly appeal to people to go, I kind of like that he said that. Whereas if certain people see the word Trump, oh, no, he's just bashing Trump. You know what I mean? Maybe I'm overthinking this. I tend to do that. But I don't know. I find him very listenable and interesting. But that's just me.
You're adding a new idea to this. My thought was that if he mentions Trump and starts bashing Trump,
yeah,
that he risks becoming just another Trump foil.
Yes.
And Trump tends to win those battles.
Yes. Yes, and I that's the strength I think that he always had to me. He's just kind of sitting back saying, all right, well, have you ever thought of this? Which, Dan, as you and I well know, is a lost art of, communicating with people.
Right, but you're adding a new idea that I hadn't thought of,
right,
which happens weekly, and it is that he might actually appeal to that swing group who voted for Trump this time around.
Yeah. Maybe
by being subtler.
Yeah, maybe they may say, oh, okay, yeah, he's kind of right there. You also have been covering a situation, Dan, another fascinating story people should read, regarding what, some teacher arrests? Explain that.
Yes, there's a fellow who was a first grade teacher at St. Gabriel School in Windsor a year ago. In the school year that ended one full year ago, and then in this past school year, he was, until he was fired in January, at Solomon Schechter Day School, which is a Jewish day school in West Hartford.
Yeah.
And in those cases, he was, and this gets to state policy. This isn't a criminal story, folks. We're getting to state policy.
Okay.
In both schools, he was accused of touching children, girls, first and second grade girls, tickling them, right? In no case was there any allegation of sexual contact, contact in any, sexual areas or sexual. This is just tickling them on their belly. Now, you could argue that that's grooming, and that's what one of the police reports does say that is grooming. And so I'm not to say that it isn't at all sexual, because that's explicitly in the police report. But what I found was that DCF, Department of Children and Families, failed to find substantiated charges of abuse or neglect, even though three separate cases led to a felony arrest. So this fellow, whose name is Ricciardi, has been arrested, or Ricciardi, if you're from Italy, has been arrested three times, twice in West Hartford and once in Windsor in the St. Gabriel case. And so police found that what he did rises to the crime of risk of injury to a minor, a Class C felony.
Yeah.
But DCF found that it did not rise to the level of a substantiated allegation of abuse. And so the obvious question is, how can that be? And the answer is, A, DCF might have been exercising its judgment the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
B, DCF might have gotten bad information. C, the police might be making an arrest that doesn't stick.
Mm-hmm.
And D, the area that I focused on, state statutes need to be cleaned up.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it is that last thing that gets the policy. And Representative Liz Linehan from Cheshire, who was the longtime Children Committee on Children co-chair and is now a deputy speaker, says that we need to clean up these state statutes.
Yeah, Dan, one thing left in about the 60 seconds we have left. I had a caller call me last week, and I've been discussing, the governor's threatened veto about this bill where some workers would get unemployment compensation after a couple of weeks. The governor still insists he's going to veto it. Your thought as to whether or not that's a landmine for him or not. Should he just veto it and not care? Because the caller asked me, do you think that would hurt him in the election if he runs again?
It would hurt him if there were a viable candidate challenging him on the left. But as I reported last week and we talked about, he's not vulnerable to a challenge from the left because there isn't a viable candidate. There are some good, solid candidates, but they couldn't win. What they could do is they could damage him, right? People like Josh Elliott and you know, maybe even the guy who wrote the letter, Senator Saud Anwar, right? They could damage the governor. Could they win? Well, listen, the campaigns are about execution. And so anybody can beat anybody if the other person doesn't execute. We all think back way back in the 90s when now Representative John Larson failed to beat Bill Curry because Bill Curry ran a better campaign. Larson had the endorsement and the polling. So the long and the short of it is, no, it's not going to hurt him because the unions need him in the general election more than they need any Republican who's going to come their way, even the relatively pro-labor Aaron Stewart, mayor of New Britain.
Excellent. Dan Haar, Hearst, Connecticut Media. Dan, thank you. Have a happy weekend, and we'll check back with you next week. Thank you, sir.
Happy Juneteenth tomorrow.
Yes, and I'm off tomorrow. Thank you, Dan. Be good. Take care.
We're off for Juneteenth.
Nice. All right. Dan Haar, Hearst, Connecticut Media. Yes.